6:05, good to have you. The Spurs get a big win in game three last night.
Lord, they had to fight for it, too.
I just couldn't hang.
I stayed till halftime.
Oh, all right. Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, they caught me a little bit after that, but I was...
Okay.
It was a no-go for me.
Yeah, I get it.
But it was an interesting game.
It was. The Spurs, really kicked it off, man. They were up by 12, and I said, oh, man, this might be a blowout.
Spurs win it 115-111. The Knicks still with a 2-1 series lead in the NBA Finals. It was also interesting, Donald Trump was there last night.
Yeah. I'm just saying, and a lot of Knicks fans are really upset. They say it was the Trump jinx that made them.
The Trump jinx.
It was the first time in 46 days that they had lost,
Yeah.
And they had a streak about 13 in a row, man, and it came to an end last night.
That's called, eventually you're going to lose.
You got to. Look, what goes
the
up comes down.
The law of averages, right? Tells you you're going to lose. And there's only been one perfect team. Well, the Miami Dolphins whatever, the 70s.
That's right, in the 70s. That's right.
They
were.
Perfect.
They did.
And it just ain't happening. No. I don't know why everybody thinks.
Well, you got to blame it on somebody.
You
got to
blame
right?
it on somebody. Yeah. Well, everybody booed Donald Trump last night.
No,
or
they
at least
didn't. They cheered. What are you talking about?
The president did say on the tarmac that he thought it was mostly cheers last night.
It was cheers.
Okay. It felt not like mostly cheers. If I'm being honest.
Okay, all right.
If I'm being honest. But, the other part, I was reading on social media before the game started.
Yeah.
And I was reading this guy's opinion, and he was saying, why would Donald Trump be at game three of the NBA Finals? Like, you're the president. You got better stuff to do. You shouldn't be going to games like this. You have, bigger fish to fry. And on top of all of that, like, fans had to get there earlier. There was a wider security perimeter, like all these things, Secret Service, all that stuff, right? And I'm thinking, like, the president has been to the Super Bowl.
He's been to Super Bowl.
He's been to the national championship game in college football. I don't know what's different.
UFC
here.
Fights. He's been everywhere. All kind of sports.
It is so wild to me to make
this
that
is New York.
The issue.
New York was going to be crazy anyway.
It's going to be crazy anyway.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know. It was wild, but Donald Trump at the game last night. Boos, he says cheers. Who's to know?
The long-awaited Gordie Howe International Bridge nearly ready to open, marking a major new connection between Detroit and Windsor. Senator Alyssa Slotkin says the ribbon-cutting ceremony is scheduled for this Friday, June 12th, with the bridge expected to open to the public on Monday, June 15th. That's according to a government source. And construction on the massive crossing began back in 2018, largely funded by the Canadian government. The bridge will feature 6 traffic lanes, dozens of inspection lanes, and direct links to major highways on both sides of the border, including I-75 and Highway 401. Officials say the publicly owned bridge will offer lower tolls than the Ambassador Bridge, with discounted rates available through a frequent traveler program. And after years of delays, the new span is set to reshape cross-border travel and trade just in time for summer. And from what I understand, the governor spoke to the president's chief of staff.
Mm-hmm, Susie Wiles.
And then after that conversation, invitations went out for Friday.
Yeah, I saw that report. I was trying to work some back channel information yesterday to figure out what exactly was going on here.
Uh-huh.
And I had reached out to somebody and I said, hey, what's exactly going on here? Is this thing opening?
Uh-huh.
And I said, can we talk about it? And they said, nothing to talk about. I'm like, okay. That was just one person that I talked to.
Okay.
So I don't know what has happened here.
Something.
Or who's rubber stamping this.
Yeah.
But interesting that it's going forward like this.
U.S. investigators have wrapped up another search effort in the Bahamas for a Michigan woman who's been missing for more than 2 months. The U.S. Coast Guard says its renewed operation to locate 56-year-old Lynette Hooker concluded Friday, but officials have not said whether any new evidence was found. Her disappearance remains under active investigation. Hooker from Onstead, Michigan, went missing April 4th during a late-night boating trip in the Sea of Abaco, and authorities say she and her husband were on a small dinghy when rough waters reportedly separated them at sea. The latest search focused on areas identified through GPS data and included divers, underwater drones, aircraft, and a search dog. Investigators also took possession of the couple's boat for forensic testing. Her husband previously questioned and released without charges, while family members have raised questions about what happened that night.
So now the status of the investigation is?
It's still ongoing.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they've called off the search for now.
Oof.
For now.
That's tough.
The Kennedy Center has removed President Donald Trump's name from its website, marking the latest turn in the ongoing dispute over the future of the iconic performing arts venue in Washington. The change comes more than a week after a federal judge ruled that the center's board of trustees acted illegally when it voted to rename the institution, ordering the restoration of its original title, the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. While Trump's name has been scrubbed from official online materials, it still appeared on signage at the front of the building as of yesterday. The controversy stems from Trump's overhaul of the center's board, which later voted to add his name to the landmark. The move drew sharp criticism and legal challenges, with the court ultimately saying only Congress has the authority to change the center's name. And the dispute now leaves the Kennedy Center branding in limbo as officials try to work out some type of deal or comply with the court order.
This was one of those issues that I just don't care about. I don't care about it. It means nothing. Like, Donald Trump puts his name on stuff all the time.
Yeah.
I've never been to the Kennedy Center. I don't care. Like, it's the name on a building. And then, you know, artists were dropping out and all that stuff.
Yeah.
It's just a building. It's just a building.
But when it's named to commemorate a president,
I'm worried about how much money you're spending. I'm worried about our national debt. I don't care what letters are drilled into the side of a building.
But I don't think it has to be, you know, either or. It could be both and.
I don't know.
I'm just saying.
There's a lot of things in life I think people are worried about.
Yeah. Oh, and I agree. I agree with that.
Just me.
I agree.
It doesn't matter.
I agree.
Dylan Larkin apparently has given the organization three teams in which he would waive his no-trade clause and be traded to. He's got a lot of power because he's got this no-trade clause. Apparently, according to reports, the Florida Panthers, the Vegas Golden Knights, and the Minnesota Wild are on the list of teams that he would waive his no-trade clause for.
Oh, okay.
And again, when in the NHL, if you are dealing for a player like Dylan Larkin, you're probably a contender. You're probably somebody who's ready to make that push and make a big time run. That's not really what Detroit needs at this point. Like, they need a haul of really good players.
Yes.
Maybe a couple draft picks, whatever it is.
Uh-huh.
But they need guys that can play now and can fill in to the,
hit the
role
ground running
that Dylan Larkin's kind of playing now.
Hit the ground skating.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. I don't know if some of, like, Florida doesn't fit that bill for me. Minnesota may a little bit more.
Okay.
But they want to push forward. So I don't think that they're giving up a lot of valuable assets to make that deal. It's just very interesting that these were the three that came out. I think that there are other people that are going to be in the mix.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
But those are the three that allegedly were part of this shortlist that he would waive his no-trade clause for. Coming up on the other side, Austin Gullett, the former Navy intel officer, is going to join us about the latest out of Iran, the negotiations that are ongoing, and the military action that just keeps popping up. It's next on JR Morning. Well, one of the things that Donald Trump has confirmed is that a U.S. Army helicopter went down near the Strait of Hormuz. It was reported by the New York Times late last night. And the president said that the pilots were not injured and that the report on the incident will be released today. He said the pilots are fine. Nobody's injured. We're going to issue a report tomorrow, but the pilots are fine. That's what he said partly on the tarmac after Game 3 of the NBA Finals. But also, two Iranian air defense troops were killed by Israeli attacks, according to Iranian state media. Iran's Emergency Medical Service Organization said that 15 Iranians were injured in Israeli attacks. 14 people in one region, one person in Tehran was also injured. But two of those troops were killed Monday. And it shows you how all of these little things, how are they playing a role into the overall negotiations that are happening to try to get a deal done. Austin Gullett is the former Navy intel officer and joins us this morning. Austin, it's good to have you back. Let's talk a little bit about the actual military strikes that have been happening. The president is urging Israel to pull back in Lebanon in particular, but these missile strikes continue. How is that impacting the talks?
Yeah, good morning. Good to talk to you again. Well, I think, big picture, Iran is really showing who they are to the world. And I think strategically, Trump still has the upper hand. I'll get back to that. But specifically with the strike, Iran really started a skirmish with Israel on Sunday night, firing missiles into Israel after Israel conducted missile strikes into Lebanon, which they had been doing. Israel's been fighting Lebanon, so that's not really a new thing. The new thing was that Israel or that Iran sent missiles into Israel. And then obviously Israel quickly answered with strikes of their own, targeting military and missile-related facilities into Iran, which is the first direct military exchange between Israel and Iran in months. So I think Iran really escalated there. And really, Iran continues to show who they are. I mean, since the ceasefire a couple months ago, Iran hasn't opened the Strait of Hormuz as they said they would. Iran obviously just conducted missile strikes in Israel, escalation certainly. Iran continues to indiscriminately strike their Gulf neighbors. They're not winning a popularity contest there. Iran will not give up their nuclear ambitions, and they continue their support for terrorist proxies. So I think Trump still has all the leverage. We have all the military might. The naval blockade is suffocating Iran economically. The frozen assets with Secretary Bessette, that's a great strategic piece, probably upwards of $100 billion. That's a major negotiating point. And then again, Iran continues to attack their neighbors. So Iran continues to show who they are. It's frustrating, but they're showing the world who they are, in case there was any doubt.
Austin, the president is predicting what he calls a total victory within 2 weeks. Is it realistic to declare victory when really neither side appears to have achieved all of its objectives?
Yeah, I mean, President Trump does, like some hyperbole. He likes to make announcements, and certainly he's active with his social media. So I don't really know. I'm sure he has something, something up his sleeve with regard to a 2 week deadline. But again, I don't think President Trump needs to really self-impose any timeline. Again, Iran is frustrating that they're not cooperating, but they are showing the world who we are, and we have all the leverage, as I just laid out. So I don't know exactly what the details are associated with the 2 weeks, but I don't think President Trump needs to self-impose that.
What is the relationship currently between Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu? The president told Jonathan Carl of ABC News, "I don't want to do anything that's going to hurt the deal, but I said you have to use your own judgment. Just go out and use your judgment, but I don't want the deal to be hurt." But we get the reports. This comes on the heels that there was a bit of a shouting match. Donald Trump was critical of Benjamin Netanyahu on some of these strikes in Lebanon. What is the relationship between the two currently?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly seems like it's probably not, it's the relationship's not at its highest, most amicable point. But, Israel's playing for keeps over there, and usually the U.S. and Israeli priorities and objectives are aligned, and sometimes they're not. And as President Trump is trying to negotiate peace, and Israel is sort of hitting the gas in Lebanon, it can make it challenging because Iran wants to support their proxy in Hezbollah. It's also interesting that here in the U.S., the counterintelligence threat has been increased on Israel. It's moved from high to critical. So there's a lot of efforts to for Israeli diplomats, sort of in their intelligence community, to really try to infiltrate, closely held talks in Washington to really try to better understand what the policy is. So, yeah, it's not great at this point, but I think strategically we're still aligned, and Iran is certainly the bad guy in the room.
The president said several regional countries have urged him to intervene. What does that tell us about how, nervous America's allies and partners are about this conflict?
I mean, I think, they obviously they don't love it, and part of Secretary Bessette's plan with those frozen funds is to help those 100 billions held in those various institutions outside Iran could be used not just to punish Iran, but also to reassure key Gulf partners that will bear some of the costs of the conflict. So, you know, demonstrating that Washington remains committed to their security. And then you also saw that Israel took their Iron Dome, you know, to UAE and was, you know, manning it with Israeli soldiers. I mean, if you had said that would happen 10 years ago, you would have been crazy. So I think there is some coalescing between the Gulf partners and the U.S. and Israel. So I think, you know, high level, nobody likes this conflict, but we're joined in our effort against Iran.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because my question is, you know, at the end of this, the region could look very different, and you might have, you know, completely new alliances that weren't quite as strong in the past that have become stronger. How has the region changed at this moment?
Yeah, well, you know, right this second, you know, specifically from the Strait of Hormuz, you just made me think of the Strait. You know, the past couple months, nearly 1,000 commercial vessels have actually transited the Strait. There's a new shipping lane that opened up on the Omani side. And, you know, a good description I heard was that there's been a quiet U.S. naval overwatch. So, you know, Iran is still leveraging pressure on their side with small boat harassment, increased insurance costs, et cetera. But, you know, Iran doesn't have the influence over the Strait. It's not absolute. So big picture, long term, I think we'll continue to adjust and limit Iran's influence over the Strait. And I think that the cooperation between the Gulf states and will continue to increase. And I think strategically, in addition to limiting Iran's ability to sow havoc in the world, I think we'll be a lot closer with our Gulf allies.
Mm. Austin Gullett, always appreciate your insight. Thank you very much. Look forward to talking with you again very soon.
Thank you all.
Yeah,
have a good one.
You got you it. Too. You do the same. Interesting. Also, Donald Trump telling Benjamin Netanyahu in a call that if they went back to war, he might be doing this alone. And that would certainly take the United States out of the picture.
Yes.
What that means, I don't know. Coming up on the other side, gas prices. Could they be impacting the auto industry yet again? We'll talk about it with Grant Schwab at the Detroit News. It's next on JR Morning. Well, gas has come down pretty substantially.
Yeah.
Here in the state of Michigan, 422 as of today. The national average is 416.
Well, you know where I go.
Yeah, you go to BJ's.
361.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
But you're putting on savings on savings at BJ.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, I get 15 cent off per gallon off with the special card that I have. So it normally it would be 15 cent more than that. So it would be, you know, 370.
Yeah,
I
mean,
it's
still
like
good.
That, which is still good.
Still below the average.
Yes.
But what's interesting here is if you look historically, what higher gas prices mean to the automotive industry, previous oil shocks, even particularly from the Middle East, there have been a number of different moments in history where that has certainly impacted the industry, as Grant Schwab writes in the Detroit News back in the 70s. And then you go into the late 2000s.
Yeah.
Right. During the financial crisis and the collapse. All of these things had a severe impact on the automotive industry, had a severe impact on us here in the Metro Detroit area. Are we seeing the same trends this time around, even though gas prices have come down a bit? Grant Schwab is our Washington correspondent with the Detroit News and part of our Mobility Maker segment today. Grant, good morning. It's good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
What are some of the similarities we're seeing to some of these other oil shocks historically and now?
So some things that are similar. Gas prices are up. That's something we've been feeling at the pump now for the last several months. We have this sort of Middle East oil shock in Iran, which is something that we've seen not quite in the same way, but, you know, having the same region of the world, similar impact on gas prices in this country is a similarity, but there are just a lot of differences. I think the differences say more than some of the similarities. And, you know, I can go down the list of differences, but I'll just start with the top line one, which is adjusted for inflation, the prices just aren't quite as high as we've seen in some of the other, you know, really big spikes you mentioned in the 70s and in the 2000s.
Have automakers, you think, learned enough from those past crises to avoid repeating the mistakes that allowed the, you know, foreign competitors to kind of gain market share decades ago?
That's a great question. And I would say, yes, they have learned quite a bit. I mean, the 70s, I think, is a really stark comparison. I mean, that was a moment when the Detroit 3, you know, Ford, GM, at the time, Chrysler, still had more than 80% market share. I mean, just wrap your mind around that, 80% market share over the entire, you know, U.S. autos market. And they were selling gas guzzlers, and they were enjoying great success without a tremendous amount of competition in this country. And they were caught pretty flat-footed. I mean, that moment is really what gave rise to the import revolution, because they didn't have the, you know, the small Toyota, Datsun, Honda models that people really liked in that moment, that people really gravitated towards. And since then, there's just a lot more variety in the market. I mean, yes, you have all those players still here, but the Detroit 3 now, I would say especially Ford and GM, they have more diversity in their product lines. I mean, with Ford, they've had great success with some of their hybrids. GM, you know, they've done really quite well on electric vehicles the last few years. So, you know, they, and then all the other automakers, you know, outside Detroit, I think they're more ready for a moment like this. There are just more high fuel economy options available on the market, that this kind of spike, again, while less severe than in the past, also there's just more product available that people might want to buy in a moment like this.
Yeah, I think that's really the key, is the landscape is completely different even than it was in the late 2000s, early 2010s. And I guess my question is, even when gas prices were climbing up near that $5 mark, they've come down substantially since then, but even when they were up to that point, is that really, like, is it high enough? Are those price surges high enough to make the same impact that it did, you know, decades ago?
For the folks that I've spoken to in the industry, they've said, no, it is not quite high enough. But they've also said, it's just not high enough yet. Like, we're still, you're right, gas prices have come down a bit since the, you know, what was it, 3-4 weeks ago, maybe a month ago, that we were up near $5. Now, in Michigan, I checked yesterday evening, we're around $4.30 a gallon, which is still, you know, more than a dollar over where we were before the war. So, yes, they've come down since the peak, but they're still up high enough. What happens if this war continues for another 6 months, for another year, for, you know, who knows how long? I mean, we've been all following the news. It could be over sooner than that. But a lot of folks have told me, hey, this shock is not high enough to change the automotive landscape right now. But if it goes for a very long time, maybe then it does start to change buying behavior in a way that we haven't seen yet.
Yeah.
One perspective I heard that was pretty interesting was that, hey, this is already layered on top of affordability issues around the economy, certainly in the automotive industry. You know what kind of cars doesn't have affordability issues? It's these Chinese vehicles that we're seeing, not yet in the U.S., but we're seeing in Europe, we're seeing in Mexico. Soon you're going to start seeing some number of them in Canada. If this gets into the brain of the American consumer that, hey, I'm not allowed to buy one of these things, one of these Chinese EVs that will be really affordable, and let's say, you know, 6 months from now, there are still a lot of issues with gas prices. If that starts to chip away at the wall we've built in this country to kind of protect us from the non-market practices of the Chinese, you know, automakers, that could become a real issue. And it's not something we're seeing yet, of course. It's sort of conjecture, but that is kind of the number one concern right now for so many folks in the auto industry, is China. So if this somehow is parlayed into demand for Chinese vehicles in this country, that's kind of scary.
Sure.
Well, Grant, we're seeing hybrid vehicle sales rise, and the EV sales are kind of slowed. Are the hybrids becoming kind of like the sweet spot for drivers who want that better fuel economy without really fully committing to an electric vehicle?
Absolutely, yes. We're seeing a pretty significant uptick in hybrid sales, but it, I will pump the brakes, so to speak, pardon the you know, the analogy, but we're still not close to 50% hybrid sales in this country. I mean, hybrids are still, I'm trying to pull the numbers up in front of me, but I think less than a quarter of all auto sales. And while it's been a successful product segment for, you know, a number of automakers, people still like their, you know, non-hybrid cars. They still like their big trucks that aren't hybrids. Mm-hmm. Like Ram sales are still, you know, very strong for, or at least this year, they've been on the rebound a bit more, mm-hmm, for Stellantis. So yes, this is an option that's available in the market, but we're not seeing a mad dash for everyone to say, hey, I need to get into a hybrid yesterday.
Really quickly, we have 30 seconds left. How does the UAE, for example, withdrawing from OPEC impact the landscape here too?
Well, I would just say that since the 70s, and really it's been the last two decades, the United States has become less dependent on foreign oil. So I imagine there will be some price impact, but it's just not as sensitive as it was 25 years ago, certainly not as sensitive as it was 50 years ago.
Yeah, interesting. Grant Schwab with the Detroit News. Thanks so much for your time. As always, we'll talk again soon. Interesting piece in the Detroit News.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you got it. Meanwhile, last week was a really, really strong jobs report.
Oh, wow.
Blew out expectations. Yes. We'll talk the effect on the economy next with Patrick Anderson. It's JR Morning. So you remember one of the things coming out of the Fed, out of Jerome Powell's last meeting, was that they may have to raise interest rates.
That's right.
And Donald Trump has come out and said, well, there's no reason to raise interest rates because the jobs report was so great. He told that to Kristen Welker. And it was a good report.
I mean, they were expecting, what, 80,000? And they ended up getting, what, 172,000?
72,000, yeah. It really was a big, big report. And the question is, okay, so what are the ripple effects of that, mm-hmm, right? What are the ripple effects? Uh-huh. Because if there are more jobs being filled, obviously that's a good thing. Unemployment is still lingering around the same spot.
4.3%.
Yeah, so that's still a little higher than we'd like. Mm-hmm. But what's the inflationary fears here? That's the question. And the president has come out and said, well, we don't need to do that. But at the same time, employment is staying steady at 4.3%. Yes, more jobs are being filled.
Uh-huh.
But there are still some numbers that are not something you'd love to see. You'd like to see some changes in other areas, too.
And some analysts think that maybe, you know, the World Cup activity may have added to the hiring.
Oh, sure.
You know,
because
we got the World Cup here. And so we'll, you know, see how much we can sustain this. But I mean, it was a great report.
It was a good report. And so, again, like coming off the heels of our conversation with Grant Schwab and gas prices affecting auto sales, things like that, people are still squeezed.
Yeah.
Right. You may not necessarily be impacted by $4.75 for a gallon of gas.
Mm-hmm.
Some are.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the domino effect of everything else. And so when you start looking at the numbers, yes, they look good. Yes, they're trending in the right direction. But agreed to your point is, how sustainable is it?
Exactly. And you got to look at wages, too. I mean, wages are up about 3.4% from a year ago. But is that enough to, you know, keep up with the rising cost of living?
I don't know. I mean, we haven't been keeping up with the rising cost of inflation for a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, things just keep getting more expensive, and it's not like people have more money. It's not like it's going any further.
It's not, and, you know, we're not matching it. Yeah.
So that's really the issue
that
here.
Yeah, all that you got to take into consideration.
Yeah. Also, the Gordie Howe Bridge gets their set date for traffic to cross the newest international bridge here in the city of Detroit. It'll open to traffic on June 15th. That is 6 days from now.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is a report that we're citing these sources.
Sources.
Mm-hmm. Right? Okay, that's all fine.
Yeah.
There is a ribbon cutting plan for Friday.
Yes.
And this is a this has been in the works for a very long time. Obviously, construction has been going on for years, but this second crossing has been talked about for
a long time,
a decade,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so now that this is moving forward, we're getting these pieces of this report that Gretchen Whitmer and Susie Wiles spoke over the phone, and that's Donald Trump's chief of staff.
Right.
Right? So what was said there? What has changed between the United States and Canada at this point? Was there some sort of trade deal made?
Mm-hmm.
Was it like these are the pieces that are left out because we just don't know yet.
Right.
The administration hasn't said anything.
But I got to feel something because the president was real high on not having this open until some kind of deal came through.
That's what he said.
Yeah.
That's what he said. And the bridge authority folks have been saying, well, look, we're ready. Like, we've been testing. We've been, you know, construction's been done for a while.
They pushed it back a little bit because they wanted it open a little earlier, but they were still doing testing and making sure everything, all the I's were dotted and T's were crossed.
And one of the things that Mark Wayne Mullen, the director of Homeland Security, said last week was that Customs and Border Protection staff are good to go to facilitate that crossing. That they've got people dedicated that are ready to be moved there and carry out that duty. So again, we're getting 95% of the puzzle, except there's still a couple pieces we're missing.
Yeah, and there's some major pieces.
They are major pieces. Uh-huh. They are major pieces. Let me ask you this: this situation with the Kennedy Center and Donald Trump needing to remove his name from it lost a court case. Is this something that you care about?
I think some people do, and I think people do. But as you said, and I agree with that too, there are, you know, some things, more important things that people need to have taken care of. But I just think we can talk about both of them. I don't think it has to be either or. Well, either talk about that or either talk about that. We can say, hey, we don't like this here, and we don't like the high prices, and we don't like what's going on with the Iran and U.S. war. But I also don't like the fact that a president can come in and basically put his name over the president's name where this facility is dedicated to and just kind of take away from it.
I guess for me, like, I only have so much outrage, room for it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm befuddled how administration after administration continues to spend our money unwisely. They continue to rack up debt. That to me is more... Like, I'm more upset about that. I'm more upset about, you know, prices still have not come down the way that many people would like.
Yeah.
I only have so much room for the stuff to be angry about.
Yeah.
And the Kennedy Center for me just isn't. It's not on the radar. Like, I get it. I understand where you're coming from. And I think there are people that feel that way.
Especially people who lived during that time when he was the president and went through all of that and dealt with Kennedy being assassinated and all of that. I mean, I think those people really have a feeling about it.
For me, it's more like forward thinking. It's more like, what do we have coming down the pipe that's going to impact us? What do we, like, AI and oversight and spending and Social Security falling off a cliff?
All of that.
And, like, these are the things that I'm outraged by because we elect you to do the job, and yet nothing's getting done.
And I agree with that.
Or, we got people insider trading on Capitol Hill.
Yep.
We've put them in positions of power, and instead of actually doing something to help people, we're worried about letters on a building.
Yeah, well, I think we can be upset with all of those things, including the letters on the building.
Yeah, fair enough. Coming up on the other side, 7 o'clock hour, we'll get you caught up on the headlines. Senate candidate Abdul El-Sayed is going to join us as well. Also, children's well-being is slipping in the United States. It was an interesting piece, and we're going to talk about that a whole lot more coming up as JR Morning rolls on here on a Tuesday morning. We'll see you at 7:05. All right, so the president was at Game 3 of the NBA Finals last night.
And he was cheered.
Here's what it sounded like inside the stadium. Thank you. was reading something online that people are like, they were chanting USA, USA.
I didn't know USA sounded like. I've never heard that.
It is not what it sounds like to
me. Maybe they were saying USA.
Maybe. Maybe we just cut it off before they got to the SA part. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know. I don't know. The president on the tarmac after the game said it was a nice time.
It was certainly amazing. It was. I think mostly cheers. It was loud and it was very enthusiastic.
Okay.
All right. It's not what it sounded like to me.
No. But, I mean, hey, you know, everybody has their opinion.
Adam Silver, before the game, pregame, was talking with Ernie Johnson and Shaq and Charles Barkley and Kenny Jett, all those guys.
Okay.
And they asked him about having Donald Trump at the game. And he said, Donald Trump is a Knicks fan. Donald Trump has had courtside tickets for a very long time at Knicks games. He used to be at a lot of games. He's done a lot of stuff with the NBA over the years. Donald Trump's a Knicks fan. If he wants to come to the game, like, we should be including everybody in the game, not excluding anybody from the game. And
okay. And
New Yorkers got the message that they had to get there early, and the place was packed and crowded, and
yeah. Everybody
got through the necessary screenings that they needed to get through, and away they went. But that was not the narrative for some who, I was reading stuff that was like, why is he there? He's the president of the United States. He doesn't get to do things anymore. Like, I'm like, that to me is bizarre.
We already know that he goes to these sporting events.
Right. He's been to all kinds of stuff. He's at the national championship game. He was at the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
I mean, he's been to all of these things. I don't know why the
UFC. He goes to UFC.
He's going to UFC all the time.
They're
going to
have a UFC fight on the White House grounds.
Yes, they are. So this is part of Donald Trump's, like, outreach program. Like, mm-hmm. This is what he does.
Yeah.
Right? Now, you go to a city like New York, where it's blue, and yes, he did make some inroads there in this last election. I mean, I'm watching people saying, I voted for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like,
right.
Wow. Those are very different folks.
Yes.
But still, very Democrat-run city. I mean, they elected Zoran Mondani. So I don't have any problem with him going. It doesn't matter to me. But, I'd be more upset if I were those fans about those ticket prices. That's crazy.
Outrageous.
Thousands and tens of thousands of dollars to get into that game only to see your team lose.
Oh, man.
I'll tell you what,
honestly. But they blame that on the president, too.
It's one of the reasons why going to those big games as a fan is a real challenge. Like, for me. Right?
Yeah.
If I'm going to pay a lot of money to go see a game and my team loses in the playoffs or in the finals, oh, I'm going to be crushed. I'm going to be so upset. I'm just going to be so upset.
Well, I mean,
that's the
money's going to be gone either way. Right. Win or lose.
You
want to spend
sure.
the money.
Yeah,
I mean, the money.
Somewhere it's going.
Yeah, it's gone.
Yeah, exactly.
Somebody's been doing some talking behind the scenes, Chris, because that long-awaited Gordie Howe International Bridge is nearly ready to open. It's going to mark a major new connection between Detroit and Windsor. Senator Alyssa Slotkin says a ribbon-cutting ceremony scheduled for this Friday, the 12th, with the bridge expected to open to the public on Monday, the 15th. Construction on the massive crossing began in 2018, largely funded by the Canadian government. The bridge will feature six lanes, dozens of inspection lanes, and direct links to major highways on both sides of the border, including 75 on our side and Highway 401 on the Canadian side. So, before they were talking about, holding it up. Now all of a sudden things are opening up.
Hmm.
Wonder what happened behind the scenes.
Well, something happened and it happened pretty quickly.
Pretty fast.
Because they got the, they got the ribbon cutting ceremony on Friday and it's going to be open in 6 days, the traffic.
Yeah.
The Lynette Hooker investigation down in the Bahamas also has taken a turn.
Yeah, the U.S. Coast Guard says its renewed operation to locate the 56-year-old Lynette Hooker concluded on Friday, but officials have not said whether any new evidence was found. Her disappearance remains under active investigation. Hooker, here from Michigan, went missing April 4th during a late-night boating trip in the Sea of Abaco, and authorities say she and her husband were on a small dinghy when rough waters reportedly separated them at sea. The latest search focused on areas identified through GPS data and included divers, underwater drones, aircraft, and a search dog as well, and investigators also took possession of the couple's boat for forensic testing. Her husband, as you know, previously questioned and released without charges, and family members have raised questions about what happened that night. So, The investigation is still active, but they just called off the search for now.
Yeah, for now.
Yeah.
U.S. CENTCOM saying that two U.S. Army Apache helicopter pilots were rescued near the Strait of Hormuz after their helicopter went down near the coast of Oman last night. A U.S. official telling ABC News that the pilots were rescued by an unmanned surface vessel. A maritime drone picked them up, took them to land. They were rescued within approximately 2 hours,
wow,
according to CENTCOM on X. And the Apache was patrolling regional waters when the incident occurred. The cause of the incident's under investigation. Rescue efforts were led by U.S. Naval Forces and the 82nd Airborne Division of the U.S. Army. It really is amazing. It is absolutely amazing. Coming up on the other side, data centers to continue to be a hot button topic for voters here in the state of Michigan. We'll be joined by U.S. Senate candidate Abdul El-Sayed. It's next on JR Morning. But first, at 7:12, time for WJR's Business Beat, brought to you by Shelving.com. We rack your world. Here's Jeff Sloan, the founder and CEO of Startup Nation, to spotlight the entrepreneurial tech and startup community on WJR.
Good morning. In spite of economic challenges facing consumers these days, like inflation, gas prices, etc., Americans plan to travel this summer, in particular to live ticketed events ranging from sports to music festivals, with the youngest generations leading the way. New data from Allianz Partners Global Travel Confidence Index sheds light on this growing trend, showing that almost two-thirds of Gen Z, 65% to be exact, and millennials are planning to attend live entertainment or experiences as a reason to travel this summer, with more than half of Gen Z travelers indicating that at the heart of their travel inspiration and ambition is interest in attending ticketed events. And of course, that's great news for the travel, entertainment, and hospitality industries. With the 2026 FIFA World Cup kicking off across North America, sporting events are leading the way in terms of the most popular events and experiences, with 38% of travelers planning trips around sporting events or tournaments. However, Americans are also in search of immersive experiences like cruises, expeditions, hobby or sport-based travel, such as marathons and running events, and spa and wellness retreats are also getting a lot of attention. Emily Hartman, general manager at Allianz Partners, said in a statement, "Travelers today are looking for more than just time away. They're seeking experiences that feel meaningful, memorable, and worth investing in. Whether it's traveling for a once-in-a-lifetime concert, a championship sporting event, or a bucket list cruise, these trips often involve significant emotional and financial investment," added Hartman. Travel to ticketed events this summer. Gonna be hot. I'm Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of StartupNation.com, the source for everything you need to start and grow your own business. And that's today's Business Beat on the great voice of the Great Lakes, WJR.
All right, so data centers is a huge topic. And why, what's been the reason why some running for office, politicians, they've kind of stayed away from it for the most part? Obviously, there is an economic benefit to these things. Now, even in places like Ohio, where they have a lot of these things,
hundreds,
right?
What I understand.
Governor Mike DeWine paused new tax breaks in Ohio for the centers last month after an independent report estimated that it had cost the state more than $1 billion in lost revenue last year. Well, $1 billion is not something to sneeze at. That's a substantial amount of money in lost revenue that they had. But you have both Republicans and Democrats running for office that say, well, what are these companies going to do? Not only the companies that are building these facilities, these AI companies, but then utility companies.
Yeah.
How are they going to juxtapose this and how are they selling it to voters? Abdul El-Sayed is running for U.S. Senate here in the state of Michigan, joins us this morning to talk about it. It's good to have you back. Where do you stand on the issue of data centers at this time?
Yeah, I mean, we're watching them pop up everywhere. And if they're going to pop up, the taxpayers shouldn't be funding them. I mean, you think about these are the biggest corporations in the history of the world. They don't need our taxpayer dollars. What they need to do is make us rich without hurting our access to electricity or our water. And so we proposed the terms of engagement. And those terms of engagement are such: if you're going to build these, you use union labor. You need to make sure that it does not touch our utility rates. In fact, some of the money that these utilities are bringing in needs to be used to improve our reliability. And then they need to have closed loop systems, which is a fancy way of don't touch our water if you're going to build these in our communities. And then there needs to be a community benefits agreement where we know how much money you're going to give to what projects in the local community. That money needs to be put up in escrow. So regardless of what happens to your data center, it's still there. And then all of this needs to be enforceable by very clear fines and fees, including the right to shut down the data center if you don't pay up. But here's the thing, right? They're using their power, these huge big tech corporations, to truck local communities, because at the end of the day, they know they can force our hand. And there's this race to the bottom. So I want to pass this all as federal legislation at the very top. So there's a floor whenever a data center project is proposed that you're going to invest in the local community rather than asking the local community to invest in you.
And, you know, you've argued that AI-related infrastructure should face regulation similar to public utilities. What would that actually look like?
That's exactly right. Look, we're talking about the most transformative technology in the history of the world. The kind of technology that's rushing in 5-10 years could fundamentally change the ability to actually sell your labor for money on the market. And so we both need ownership as a public. Any of the money that is made has to be spread around to the folks who might lose jobs as a function of it. But we also need control. So there's a bunch of different ways you could think about this. You could think about a federal agency that sits over top, kind of like the Fed does when it comes to banking, sits over top of the industry to make sure that they're not running amok or failing basic security tests. Or you could imagine making sure that you have some sort of democratic appointment on all the boards of these hyperscaler companies. But there needs to be both ownership and control to make sure that the kind of technology that has huge implications for the public does not happen without the public's oversight.
Are you hearing that this is as big of an issue amongst folks that you're talking to as you're running around the state? Is this a bigger issue in the metro area? Is it a big issue outstate? What are you hearing from people?
Look, I've been to more than 100 different cities across the state of Michigan over the last year. There is not a place that I go where the question about either data centers or AI doesn't pop up. It's everywhere. It's coming fast. People understand that has huge impacts on your ability to even make money. It has huge impacts on your local community. And if we don't get this right, we might miss the opportunity to actually do anything about it. So I can be in Escanaba. I can be in Sault Ste. Marie. I can be in the city of Detroit or Grand Rapids. People bring it up. They're worried.
Some critics, though, have argued that campaign donations and you know, lobbying dollars make it difficult for politicians to challenge these powerful AI and tech interests. Is that a legitimate concern?
Yeah, I'm one of them. Look, I've never taken a dime from a corporation, not DTE, not Consumers Energy, and not big tech. I'm the only person running for U.S. Senate, Democrat or Republican, who can say that. And so I think you're absolutely right. You're talking about the richest corporations in the history of the world, whose technology is going to make them richer. And if we don't regulate this soon, I worry that the horse will have left the barn. You're talking about companies that can then use their money to spend $100 million every 2 years to shape the outcomes of elections to make sure that people who get elected aren't willing to touch their cash cow. And I think that's entirely the wrong way about it. And it happens across every sector of our lives, but this one's uniquely important because of how fast this is moving. So I'm the only person who's never taken a check from big tech or the utilities. And so it's important for me to stand up and say, look, we need regulation now to make sure that this is all happening in the best interest of the people, not a few billionaires out in San Francisco.
You were able to pick up an endorsement from the United Auto Workers. That's a big get for you and your campaign. I'm curious to know how, I mean, we're seeing in these tight races around the country and even some maybe problematic ones out in Maine with Graham Plattner, for example. How are all of these things coalescing in your campaign? How are you using them in your favor over those that you're running against?
Look, I'm really grateful to earn the endorsement of the UAW. So honored, because my dad literally came to this country from Egypt to design cars. He understood that the heart of the auto industry were the folks who built them, and that's the UAW. But right now, the UAW is fighting for working people in every sector. They understand that corporations and their interests are more focused on the quarterly bottom line, things like stock buybacks, using their money to buy stock to artificially expand the price of their stock so the CEO looks better on paper, than they are interested in making sure that the people who built their companies are benefiting or that there's a long-term profitability opportunity for those companies. So look, this is a challenge that you see across the board. Right now, it's harder and harder to live your life. People are worried that they're being priced out of healthcare. They're being priced out of the opportunity for a job. They can't afford a basic education or a home for their kids. and they're angry about it. And they understand that the establishment in both sides of our politics, Democrat or Republican, are playing the same corporate game. I think that's why you're seeing people who are rising up and standing up to corporations step up in elections and do pretty well. I know my name is Abdul El-Sayed. I got an uncommon name. I'm not supposed to run for office. I knew that the day I realized that my name was as different as it was. But the reality of it is that people are sick and tired. They're less interested in your name, whether or not you care about knowing their name and care about fighting for them. And that's what we're doing in this race. And I think you're seeing it all over the country.
And, you know, some labor unions support data center construction because of the jobs they create. How do you reconcile labor's support for those projects with community concerns about energy costs and the impact on the environment?
And look, if you're a union and you build stuff, you want to build stuff. And data centers are the stuff that's getting funded to get built. That's why I think it's important for us to establish a floor to say, look, when you build these things, we got to make sure it's in the best interest of everybody. Because I've talked to a lot of folks in these unions. They say, look, I want to build this because that means a meal on the table for my kid. But I don't want to have to go home afterwards because I got a job for 3 months, built this data center, and then I'm paying three times as much for my electricity bill. And meanwhile, my water is brown coming out of the faucet. So we need policy that's going to address all of this. And so we're working alongside unions to figure out how to do this in a clean way that puts money up front and people up front rather than corporations and their interests up front.
U.S. Senate candidate Abdul El-Sayed, thanks for your time this morning. We'll talk again soon.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, you got it. Hey, you know, and remember, there were a lot of UAW members that were supporting Donald Trump in the last race, too. The UAW did endorse Kamala Harris, but there were a lot of folks inside the union that were supporting Donald Trump.
Way.
Interesting. Yeah. We'll take a break. Coming up on the other side, get you caught up on the headlines. It's JR Morning. So the bridge is opening up. That's good for commerce here in Metro Detroit. And some backrooms deals may have been done, some talking behind the scenes. Governor Gretchen Whitmer and Chief of Staff Susie Wiles have talked. How about that?
Listen, and we've been talking about, you know, it's going to open in spring. It's going to open up this spring. We don't have a date yet. It's going to open up in spring. We didn't know. It's going to open up this year. And finally, we have dates. Ribbon cutting Friday, open Monday.
Terrific.
Something happened.
And look, I don't really care, honestly.
No.
Like, get that thing open. Let's get it moving.
Yeah.
Let's get it moving. So I'm happy to hear that.
I am, too.
When that came yesterday.
I know some people are probably not so happy to hear it.
Like who?
The Ambassador Bridge people.
Oh, yeah.
They're probably not happy to hear
it. Yeah, yeah. Probably not.
Yeah, no.
Probably
no.
not. But that's, look.
It's competition. It is what it is, right?
It's competition. I don't think, I mean, I think you're going to get traffic on both sides.
Oh, you're definitely going to get traffic
like,
on both sides.
I don't think it's going to, I mean, maybe it will impact things a bit, but hopefully not.
Well, the tolls are supposed to be cheaper on the new one.
True. Yeah.
True. You know.
Yeah.
But I still think you're going to still get traffic on both bridges.
So Helene St. James in the Detroit Free Press also put a piece out yesterday about the three places that Dylan Larkin would waive his no trade clause for. And those three organizations are the Florida Panthers, the Las Vegas Golden Knights, and the Minnesota Wild.
Any particular reason why you think he picked those three?
Why do I think they picked the, okay. All right. So here's why I think so.
Okay.
First of all, I do believe Vegas is playing for a Stanley Cup right now.
That's true.
So they've got a good roster.
Uh-huh.
Minnesota, though, he's got friends on that team, USA players that just won a gold medal altogether.
Okay, yeah, mm-hmm.
Play on that team. He's very close with Quinn Hughes, Matt Boldy, Brock Faber, a couple other guys there. And the same goes for Florida as well. Matthew Tkachuk plays for the Florida Panthers. So I think what happened here, here's what I kind of think happened.
Okay.
I think there was some sort of rift between him and Steve Yzerman going back even to last season.
A lot of people feel that way, yeah.
Right?
Uh-huh.
Whether it was Larkin coming out last year after the season ended saying, you know, I wish we would have added. There was a bit, you know, we didn't have a lot of juice coming out of the trade deadline. I wish we would have added.
Sure, yeah.
Not that that's an excuse not to make the playoffs because they were in a position to make the playoffs. This year, Steve Yzerman said something in his postseason presser to the effect of like, yeah, we need more from Dylan Larkin. He can be better. And I wonder if all of these things – whatever maybe animosity there was between he and Steve Yzerman or is between he and Steve Yzerman or not, because things were even contentious when they were re-signing him to that deal.
Uh-huh.
But I think Dylan Larkin at this point sees what it takes to win. And I think that getting that taste playing with Team USA in Italy, I think there is a piece of that that is at play here. Meaning he had success. He knows what it takes to play at the highest level.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a productive player for them in Italy.
Yes.
So I, a part of me just looks at it and goes, I think Dylan Larkin wants to win. Dylan Larkin is a winner. And he, at this point, looks at this team and goes, I don't see it.
Yeah.
Now, there could be an element of forcing Steve Yzerman's hand, like trade me or bring some people in. Let's improve this roster. That could be at play, too.
That could be.
But I think he wants out. I think he wants to try to go win a Stanley Cup. And I don't believe feels like he could do that here.
Well, I mean, you made a good case for all three of those teams.
And
especially Vegas.
You're going to need a haul. Dylan Larkin is going to demand a substantial return in any trade. He's not a superstar player. He would be a really good second-line center. He plays first line here. It's probably a little bit out of position for him, but that's the necessity that they have to fill.
Yeah.
So it would require a big deal to get him, and that would benefit the Red Wings.
It would.
It would benefit them. But it stinks when this happens, when you've got a guy who's, you know, from here, played college hockey here, drafted here. You know, it's a perfect story. It's Aiden Hutchinson, except on the ice.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Wings know that something has to happen. Something has to give. They got to give.
Yeah, something's got to give.
You know.
More information coming out on these Apache helicopter pilots that crashed.
Yeah.
Off the coast of Oman. They were rescued just 2 hours after their helicopter went down by a unmanned surface vessel, a maritime drone. It picked them up and brought them to safety. CENTCOM saying on X that they were patrolling regional waters, and the cause of the incident is still under investigation. But it is something, a feat of our military that we can go in and grab those guys with a drone.
Right, unmanned.
An unmanned drone. Meanwhile, you had two Iranian air defense troops killed by Israeli attacks, according to their state media. And Donald Trump says he sees no sticking points in these Iranian talks. He says negotiations with Iran are ongoing and that he could have an agreement or at least an idea of one in a couple of days from now, according to the president.
Well, and he also said it'll be, you know, a deal done within 2 weeks.
Yeah. I think Donald Trump does hold the cards. I think the United States is in the stronger position.
Oh, I agree.
I actually 100%. Don't think it's a question.
No, I agree.
Point.
Yes, no, 100%.
But he does have problems here at home.
Yeah.
He's got political issues here at home.
Yeah.
And again, when you compound the conflict with Iran, I don't know if we call it a war at this point, whatever. Whatever's going on there. And the financial strain that it's putting on people here.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got all of the politics, the primaries and the midterms that are upcoming. All of those things are problematic for Donald Trump at this point. I don't think anybody can dispute that. No. So you've got problems at home. You do have the cards. You do hold the higher hand against Iran.
Yeah.
But they're waiting you out.
They can take a lot. You know, their tolerance for pain is a lot. Iran is. I think they're tolerant because they're hurting. You know they're hurting.
Well, they're hurting. Their tolerance for pain exists because they're a brutal regime.
Yeah.
That doesn't give a hoo-hoo about any of their people.
That's it in a nutshell.
So they can take the pain. They don't really care what's going on.
Yeah, because they're eating. They're fine.
Right.
It's the people that are suffering.
So the 90% of the people that want out of this system, the folks that are hemorrhaging jobs and hemorrhaging money, and you know the hundreds of millions of dollars that is being economically held back by Iran at this point, all of these things are impacting those people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the regime doesn't care about that. So it is a weird dance that they have to do now, the president, because the United States put themselves in a position to get this done, to get a deal done, and to somehow fall short of that is a no-go. So that's why they are committed to this at this point.
And you know, Bibi Netanyahu has to cooperate too, you know,
well,
because the president wants him to cooperate to help make sure this deal can get done.
The president says that if you don't cooperate, you're going alone.
That's not going to end well.
I don't think it ends well necessarily. I mean, I don't know how long that would be the mantra
yeah.
of the United States. I don't know how long that would be the case, but certainly if Donald Trump's perspective is deal, we are getting a deal.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not going to be a part of this, then we're not going to help you.
Go for it.
It would be problematic, certainly. Coming up on the other side, are children's well-being slipping in the United States? We'll examine that. It's JR Morning. You know, one of the things that we've been talking about for a long time is our education slide here in the state of Michigan.
Absolutely.
You know, literacy scores, math efficiency. It's just, it is well below where a state like Michigan should be. And there's an interesting piece in Axios. Children's well-being in the United States has declined since the pandemic, with kids in 29 states doing worse than they were before COVID.
Mm-hmm.
It's the new Kids Count data book, and it warns that major factors are driving the drop, including academic setbacks, mental health struggles, and economic pressure on different families. And that's problematic.
It is.
Leslie Bossier is Vice President of External Affairs at the Annie E. Casey Foundation and joins us this morning. Leslie, good morning. It's good to have you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Why is this such a problem? Why are kids in 29 states doing worse than they were 6 years ago?
Well, it's a comprehensive issue. We know that when states invest in the well-being of kids that they do well, and we've seen that play itself out in the data, the most concerning area is the area of education, where 47 states saw declines in fourth grade reading and eighth grade math scores. And we know those are foundational skills for children to have if they are going to be thriving adults.
Also, you know, one of the alarming statistics is the increase in child and teen deaths. What factors are driving that trend?
Well, we know that for several years there has been a mental health crisis among teenagers and children as well. We have seen some positive trends in terms of states that are investing in placing mental health professionals inside the school system, which is the system that touches all children. But there need to be more investment in intervention, in making sure that young people have the supports that they need so that they are mentally that we are supporting their mental well-being in the same way that we support their physical well-being.
What does this mean for the future? What does this mean for those children in the next 10 to 15 years when they enter the workforce and when they get into college? Are we setting ourselves up for a potentially weaker workforce at some point?
That is such an important question, because today's students are tomorrow's workforce, and workforce is the ultimate measure of our economy. So if we intend to have a strong economy going forward, we have to invest in children today. We know that when children are safe, are well-fed, when they have strong relationships with their families, that they thrive. And if we want to have a thriving economy, we have to support thriving children today.
And I know you're expressing concern about fewer children being enrolled in Medicaid and more children becoming uninsured. Why is that such a significant warning sign?
Well, what we know is that health is an important indicator of the overall well-being of kids. And we know that for low-income families, programs like Medicaid and CHIP are important ways that they have access, in some places the only way that they have access to health insurance, so that they get preventative care or so that they can see a physician when they need to. And there's early data from organizations like the Georgetown Center on Children and Families that's showing significant declines in the number of kids who are enrolled in these programs. And it's an important trend for us to watch, because we want to make sure that kids have the support and have the basics that they need so they can do well.
What role do parents play in all of this?
parents are critical. Parents are foundational. Without the supporting relationships of parents, we know that kids cannot thrive. We also know that 61% of poor kids live in a household with working parents. And so it's critically important that families have the resources that they need so that they can provide the basic needs for their children, like enough food to eat, like a safe and stable home, and like a quality education.
And, you know, and despite some troubling figures, there are some positive developments in the report as well. The teen birth rate has fallen dramatically over the last several decades. What does that success story kind of teach us about sustained investment and long-term planning?
That is such an inspiring bright spot, because we know that for decades we have invested in reducing the number of teenagers that have kids. We know, based on data and research, that delaying having a child until after the age of 25, when you have a solid education, when you've entered the workforce, has a significant impact on the long-term economic well-being of that young person, as well as of any children that they might bear. So it's an important and lesson to learn in terms of when we invest in a particular area, we see success. And such a statement about the opportunity that we have to invest, to follow the data and invest in what we know works for kids so that they can do well.
Leslie Bossier, the Vice President of External Affairs at the Anna E. Casey Foundation. Thank you so much for your time this morning. Really interesting look, and it should be an alarm that we need to do more for our kids. Thank you.
Thank you for sounding the alarm.
Yeah, you got it.
Absolutely.
Also, how about this? Ready for this one? You remember Neuralink?
Yeah.
Elon Musk's brain chip? Mm-hmm. That would help those dealing with severe spinal cord injuries, paralysis, different things like that. Yeah. China has beaten Elon Musk to market. NIO is been approved in China.
Wow.
And not just for clinical trials, for real inpatient usage.
Wow.
It is designed to help people with paralysis or spinal cord injuries by translating brain signals into movement, like controlling a robotic hand or a computer. China's regulator approved the chip. Neuralink still in limited human testing. Has not yet been cleared yet. China's version, interesting enough, is less invasive. Neuralink was an implant.
An implant, yes.
In the brain.
Right.
NIO is not. It sits on the brain surface, which made it safer and an easier approval process. But it is a major, major milestone in this technology.
So you're talking about people who are paralyzed, can't walk, may be able to walk again.
I think it's... I don't know that it's walking quite yet.
Okay.
I think it would take, it's going to take some time to get to that point. But
well, we're
the
there,
use
I
of
mean,
arms or hand movement things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we got to start somewhere.
Right.
And that, you know.
Right. I mean, this is a big, big deal. Big deal.
Wow. You know, and it's going to, I just think technology is just amazing. And I just think it's going to come a time, if we're doing this now, there may be a time where they'll have something to help the blind to see.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean,
at some point, yes.
Yeah.
Sure.
I mean, because technology is just amazing.
But again, what we're blending here, and it's not the first time necessarily,
no.
But like you're blending human computers. It's human computer interaction that you're blending here.
Mm-hmm.
That you are now, through this technology, able to move your arm. If you've been in a serious injury and you are left paralyzed,
All
of a sudden now you have some sort of range of motion.
I mean, baby steps.
Stunning.
But that's huge.
Absolutely
huge.
Stunning. I don't know that I would be real into it.
Why is that?
It just feels wild to me. But I think if you're in that position, right, you're willing to try anything.
Oh,
you're willing to take any steps necessary
absolutely
to give yourself some of that freedom.
Yes.
Yeah. Unbelievable. By the way, here's your chance to win a trip to see Lionel Richie and Earth, Wind & Fire in the city of your choice. We've got flights, hotel, concert tickets, and premium VIP lounge access covered. It's your chance to sing along all night long with Lionel Richie and Earth, Wind & Fire. Prizes provided by Live Nation. Texas Hours National Keyword. Ceiling to 95819. That's CEILING. And we'll text you back to confirm your entry. Data and messaging rate may apply. Don't text and drive. Play four times each weekday for four chances to win. Official rules are at WJR.com. I gotta be honest, I don't really care that Donald Trump went to the game last night in New York.
He does. He goes to games, all kind of games, all kind of sporting events. He's there. So, I mean,
It's well, Stephen like A. Smith went on this whole diatribe on ESPN about how he shouldn't have been at the game.
Right. Or, a lot of fans feel like the Knicks lost last night because he jinxed them. It's just crazy. He goes to sporting events. That's just what he does.
I hope he goes to every Knicks game going forward.
Well, the next one is Wednesday. We'll see.
Who can? I mean, whatever. Again, it's like this guy can't do anything. He can't do anything.
Wow.
Just whatever it is, there's a criticism. Which, okay, you're the president of the United States. You'll get criticism.
Well,
that's fine.
That's just part of the deal.
I just, you know. But like, again, I don't know why people are. Well, I guess if you had to get there 2 hours early and you had to get through extra security, I don't know. It's inconvenient, I suppose.
Well, I would think that, first of all, it's in New York.
Right.
And so the security is going to be high anyway. And they just had a stabbing at Penn Station.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the security was going to be crazy anyway. So, I don't know.
It's wild criticism. What isn't wild criticism is of what the president said were mostly cheers last night.
Yeah.
I didn't get that from
okay.
this.
All right.
Those
you didn't hear any whistles?
I did not get this.
It was certainly amazing. It was I think mostly cheers. It was loud and it was very enthusiastic.
Maybe for the game there were cheers.
Well,
maybe for the actual play on the court.
Listen,
it didn't sound like that during when they showed him during the national anthem.
Well, some people will say, well, you know, the president is telling a fib. He's lying. But it's not a lie if that's what you believe.
Well, it's maybe there were people around him that were cheering. I don't know.
Hey.
I don't know, but you that's know? Not what it sounded like on the broadcast. I'll tell you that. It sounded like a resounding boo.
No.
When he was showing on the big
USA,
screen.
USA, and we cut off the SA.
That's it. We just missed that part.
Exactly.
Yeah. Also, speaking of the president, he did confirm on the tarmac last night when he made those comments that those two Apache helicopter pilots were rescued, and we're getting a little more information this morning. They were actually rescued by a maritime drone, an unmanned maritime drone.
Wow.
2 hours after their Apache helicopter went down.
Technology.
They're safe. They're good. And, yeah, they were able to be rescued.
We're going to have a second bridge crossing.
Any day now.
Very soon. The long-awaited Gordie Howe Bridge ready to open, marking this new major connection between Detroit and Windsor. Senator Alyssa Slotkin saying a ribbon-cutting ceremony scheduled for this Friday, June 12th. The bridge is expected to open to the public on Monday, June 15th. And construction on the massive crossing began back in 2018. Largely funded by the Canadian government, the bridge will feature 6 traffic lanes, dozens of inspection lanes, and direct links to major highways on both sides, including 75 and Highway 401. Officials say the publicly owned bridge will offer lower tolls than the Ambassador Bridge, with discounted rates available through a frequent traveler program. So, you know, it was all this talk about this was not going to happen. The president was going to hold it up. But there have been some conversations, I understand, behind the scenes.
Yeah, Governor Gretchen Whitmer, Susie Wiles, the chief of staff to Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
So there seems to be some sort of movement.
Yeah.
Some sort of movement that is pushing this thing forward. Meanwhile, the Lynette Hooker case is very interesting to me. So she went missing April 4th. Her husband said bad weather caused her to go overboard. They were heading to a larger boat. They were on like a little dinghy.
Mm-hmm.
She went overboard and hasn't been seen since. Forensic evidence found on electronic devices belonging to Brian Hooker, her husband, led investigators to new area of interest that GPS data that they obtained was not the same that Brian Hooker had told them about.
Right.
And that has now changed the way that they're investigating this. They've stopped their search efforts at this point.
Yeah, they have at this point, and you know, we'll see what happens. They had the GPS data that they were following.
Yeah.
You know, divers, underwater drones, aircraft, search mm-hmm. dog, they had a whole deal going on, and so we'll see what happens. It's not done. I mean, like you said, it's still open. The investigation is still open. It's just the search has been called off at this point. Now, you love this story.
I love it.
Yeah, the Kennedy Center. has removed President Donald Trump's name from its website, marking the latest turn in an ongoing dispute over the future of the performing arts venue in D.C. The change comes more than a week after a federal judge ruled that the center's board of trustees acted illegally when it voted to rename the institution, ordering the restoration of its original title, the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. While Trump's name has been scrubbed from official online materials, it still appeared on signage at the front of the building as of yesterday. The controversy stems from Trump's overhaul of the center's board, which later voted to add his name to the landmark.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't care.
Don't care.
Doesn't faze you at all.
On, not, doesn't matter. It's just a building where people go and put on musicals or music acts. It doesn't matter to me.
Yeah, I just think, you know, for those who were around when John F. Kennedy was president, and the fact that it was named after him as a tribute to him, I think they feel a certain kind of way about it, you know.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, Bill in Dearborn texted in a little bit ago. Chris, the question is, why does the president have the need to put his name on buildings that he doesn't own? I don't know. I don't have an answer to that. Donald Trump wants to leave a legacy. Donald Trump wants to leave some sort of mark.
Yeah.
Right? That's why we're talking about the ballroom. That's mm-hmm. why we're talking about the arch. That's why we're talking about the Kennedy Center.
They were talking about renaming the airport, too.
Yes, renaming, you know? Yes.
Was it Dulles?
It was the other one.
I can't think of it at the moment. Not the
Reagan.
Reagan. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to fly into an airport. I'm not flying in or not flying in because it's the Trump-Reagan airport.
Yeah.
I'm not going to see a show because it's the Kennedy Center or the Trump-Kennedy Center. I don't care. It doesn't matter to me. It's just the building. It's a building mm-hmm. with letters that were screwed into the facade. That's all it is.
Yeah.
Now, did we go through the proper channels? Obviously not. But I don't care.
Yeah, I think it's
just... I got bigger fish different. To fry.
Yeah.
You're not spending my money properly. I got insider trading on Capitol Hill. All of these
and
things...
And that's all legitimate.
Yeah,
but it could be a both and instead of either or. That's just me.
Yeah, it's fair. Dylan Larkin, according to Helene St. James in the Detroit Free Press... has named the three teams that he would waive his no-trade clause for, including the Florida Panthers, the Las Vegas Golden Knights, and the Minnesota Wild. Minnesota's loaded for bear. They're ready to rock. If they were able to get Dylan Larkin on that team, they would certainly be a Stanley Cup favorite.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
I would be interested to know what they've got to offer. They've got a lot of prospects. They are a loaded team right now. But... they also gave up a lot when they traded for Quinn Hughes midway through
yes.
the season.
Mm-hmm.
So there is something to be mindful of there. But all of these teams have some sort of connection to USA Hockey and where Dylan Larkin just won a gold medal with.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So there, I think that plays a role where you go, you get a taste of success.
Yes.
Right? You win the gold medal with a bunch of your friends. And
it's
all of a
feeling
sudden.
That you want to keep having.
All of a sudden, the competitor really comes out and goes, is that going to happen here?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is it really going to happen here? Because this doesn't look like a team that I just played on for a couple of weeks that is ready to rock.
Mm-mm.
But again, that's essentially an all-star team, right?
Well, yeah.
These are essentially all-star teams
for the
USA and Canada.
And that's a little, yeah. And so you got to kind of look at it in a different.
Yeah, it's not quite apples to apples.
Apples,
yeah.
Right. Can I just mention real quickly, Ford Motor Company is teaming up with Bloomberg Philanthropies and a $5 million investment aimed at tackling a major shortage of auto technicians and reshaping the workforce training in Detroit. Ford CEO Jim Farley and former New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg visited Brythorp Career and Technical Center, where the funding will modernize training programs and restart auto technician education at Western International High School in Detroit. The investment will upgrade classrooms, expand certifications and internships, and help remove better barriers for students entering skilled trades. So that's a
cool.
Good deal for DPS.
Absolutely. Coming up on the other side, we're talking Tigers. They got the Twins tonight. All that and more. It's JR Morning. So the Tigers have won 5 of their last 6 games. They swept the Rays. They won 2 of 3 from Seattle. And all of a sudden, you know, Gleyber Torres gets back in the lineup.
Yeah.
They look like a different team. Then you got Tarek Skubal in his little outing at West Michigan.
At West Michigan, yeah.
Looked really good. He seems to be on track way, way, way earlier than we expected. Justin Verlander is progressing nicely.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the injury issues that the Tigers have had early on, some of these guys are coming back and hopefully will make a serious mark of improvement here for this team going forward. Cody Stavenhagen is the senior writer for The Athletic for the Detroit Tigers and joins us. Cody, good morning. It's good to have you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It does feel like injuries have played a large role into why they're 27-39, why they're tied with Kansas City for the bottom of the AL Central. But can they claw their way out of this? Can they dig themselves out of the hole if they get some of these guys back?
Well, yeah, that's definitely the big question right now. And to your point, I think Sunday was maybe the most positive day around the Tigers since, opening day. The combination of a walk-off win and Tarek Skubal pitching well in his rehab assignment. Problem is they've dug themselves a very deep hole. Despite winning 5 out of 6, they're still 12 games under 500. Now in a weak American League, only about 5.5 games out of the third and final wild card spot. So it's not impossible. There is still time, but the margin for error is also very thin. The Tigers have to keep stacking wins. They have to play above a 600 clip from here on out, you know, if they just even want to match like 87 wins, which is what they finished with last year. They might be able to get into the playoffs with fewer than 87 wins, but the point stands, they have to play really well for really the rest of the season. There's little room for another slump.
And the Tigers rank near the bottom of baseball offensively. Is this a talent issue? Is it an injury issue or a development issue?
Yeah, I think a little bit of all that, right? One of the things batting around in my mind throughout the course of May was like, how much of this is the injuries and how much of this goes beyond? The Tigers were 6-22 in May. I think some of it went far beyond the injuries. They just weren't playing well. There were established players. Spencer Torkelson, Zach McKinstry, Matt Vierling, Wenzel Perez, Jamai Jones, and more who were not performing. So it wasn't just the injuries. But we did see pretty quickly, oh yeah, this lineup does look a lot better when you get a steady right-handed bat in Gleyber Torres, when you get a big lefty power bat in Kerry Carpenter. The entire complexion of the lineup does change when those guys are back. But one of the issues is, and maybe still has been, all those struggling players I just listed, plus some others, there haven't really been great options to replace them, whether that's in AAA Toledo or elsewhere in the organization. The Tigers still have a pretty good farm system, all things considered. They have a few highly touted guys still on the farm, but the depth has thinned out pretty quickly. And like, is that a development issue or is that just the way these things go? I'm not quite sure, but it would be nice if you felt like you could call on someone in Toledo to improve your team, and they haven't necessarily had that.
Well, I mean, injuries are inevitable throughout the season. Unfortunately, they've had a lot, and so when you got to replace all those guys, you are going to see a drop in production, especially if some of those guys in AAA or as you mentioned elsewhere. They just might not be ready.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been a huge bugaboo for them. I'm most interested in what happens with Tarek Skubal now. I mean, he looked really good the other day out at West Michigan, threw 5 scoreless, 2 hits, 5 strikeouts. Kind of looked like Tarek Skubal. It looked very much like a stat line for him through 5. What happens if he comes back? I don't love to play the what-if game, but let's just hypothetically say he comes back and is vintage Tarek Skubal. Do you think the organization looks at it and says, well, let's try to make a push, or do they try to move him at the deadline?
Yeah, I mean, this isn't necessarily the most fun answer, but
no.
I think the correct answer is like, wait and see. It completely depends on how the Tigers play for the next 6+ weeks. I don't think they're going to trade him next week. I don't think they're going to trade him probably even in early July. I think they're going to give this as much time as possible to try to allow this team to get back in the hunt. And if they are able to do that, I think they would love to try to keep Tarek Skubal for the rest of the season and make a run at it. The question is kind of like, how do you define in contention or in the hunt? Is that all the way back in the playoff picture? Is that 3 games out of a wild card spot, 5 games out of a wild card spot? Where will they draw the line in the sand and say, all right, you know what, we're out of it? And if they're out of it, the reality is they're going to have to trade Tarek Skubal and get as much as they possibly can in return. All eyes across the whole sport are on Skubal. Other teams are watching him. very closely. Based on what I've seen, he does look like himself. I think he's going to pitch pretty close to what we are all used to. But it's really about where the team is in the standings and if they can get back in this thing and kind of salvage their season.
You know, and Tiger fans are also watching Justin Verlander closely at this stage of his career. You know, what would constitute a successful return for Verlander? I mean, how much of a lift could his presence kind of provide, not just on the field, but also in the clubhouse?
Yeah, I mean, Verlander's been around this clubhouse all year. It is a little different when he's not active and he's not pitching. And, you know, the experience, the edge he brings could still be a positive thing for this team. But at this point, after such a long rehab and recovery, I think you're just hoping to get him to the major leagues. That's kind of step one, make sure he can get there. And then step two is like, yeah, make sure he can still be a capable pitcher. We don't necessarily really know. We've only seen him once all season. He did get batted around, and then this rehab has been really long, really slow. I do think it's kind of important to remember Justin Verlander is 43 years old. And yeah, assuming he makes it back to Comerica Park, there's going to be that urge for the JV nostalgia, but like, this isn't 2006 or 2009 or 2012. Really, JV's a fourth or fifth starter. You're hoping he can give you some quality innings.
Yeah. Cody Stavenhagen, thanks so much for your time, your insight. We appreciate it. We'll talk again soon.
All right. Sounds good. Appreciate
it,
guys.
Yeah, you got it. They got the Twins tonight, 6:40 first pitch down at Comerica Park.
Yeah, my son's taking his daughter now.
Oh, nice.
They're going to have a little daddy-daughter thing.
That's very cool. Yeah. Just keep the winning ways going.
Yes.
Make sure they bring the good luck with them. That's all it's about. Coming up on the other side, the tick population here in Michigan is exploding. What you need to know, coming up next here on JR Morning. Well, Michigan health officials are warning that Lyme disease is rapidly rising across the state of Michigan. It's quadrupled in recent years. And it's being driven by an explosion in the tick population, especially black-legged ticks that carry Lyme disease.
Yeah.
Why is this happening? What's causing it? Let's talk about it. Rachel Burkholder is the vector-borne disease epidemiologist at the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services and joined us. Rachel, good morning. It's good to have you.
Good morning.
What is causing the quadrupling in recent years of Lyme disease, of tick bites, of the tick population here in the state of Michigan?
You know, there are a lot of variables that play a part in the growth of the tick population. That can include things like they reproduce in very large numbers. They love our hot, humid summers, and Michigan is just covered in perfect ecology for their habitat. So the forested areas that we have. And there are a lot of animals that spread ticks and spread disease.
Not all ticks are the same. I mean, can you explain the difference between like the black-legged ticks and the American dog ticks and why that distinction matters?
Yeah, so we do have both of those ticks. The black-legged tick is the one that spreads Lyme disease and a couple of other diseases, anaplasmosis, babesiosis. And it's much, much smaller than the American dog tick. And so it's harder to find once it's attached to your body. The American dog tick does spread some diseases, but we don't typically see those here in Michigan.
Interesting. I had heard once that if you do get a tick bite and you notice it and you have the tick, mm-hmm. you know, that you pull out of your skin,
yeah.
that you should freeze it. Then that way you can turn it over once you alert the state or you alert your medical officials of this bite that they can actually test it. Is that true?
We don't offer tick testing, and okay. The reason for that is if it's positive for any pathogens, it doesn't mean that the person that was bitten is positive for any pathogens.
Got it.
And if it's negative, it doesn't mean they're negative either, because you could have missed a tick you didn't know about. So it just doesn't really tell us anything.
What about using insect repellents? How important are they in preventing tick bites?
That's the best way to prevent tick bites, and if you're using any type of repellent, we recommend that it's EPA approved. You can check EPA's website to find out what is EPA approved. There's also picaridin or lemon eucalyptus oil. And there's a product called permethrin that you can actually treat your clothing with. Mm-hmm. Permethrin is for clothes, not skin, that will actually kill the tick on contact.
Mm. What are some of the effects of Lyme disease? It can show up differently in different people. It can be more severe in others. What are some of the things you look for?
Yeah, definitely. And very first off, it's going to show up as, you know, flu-like symptoms. A lot of tick-borne diseases and even mosquito-borne diseases show up the same in the beginning. Very fever, headache, fatigue. Lyme disease, you've probably heard, has this bullseye-shaped rash that will show up. And what's important to note about that is it's not always a bullseye, but the most important factors are that it doesn't itch and it's not painful. So that's something that'll show up in the beginning. And then a lot of these diseases, including Lyme, can increase into things like encephalitis, meningitis, arthritis, just more severe symptoms.
And beyond protecting ourselves, what can homeowners do to, you know, make sure their yards are less attractive to ticks? Every now and then I'll see Mr. Deer in the backyard just kind of cooling out in my yard, laying out there. So what can we do to kind of make it less attractive for ticks?
Yeah, you can keep your grass cut short. Black-legged ticks can't handle the sun, and so they will kind of dry out and die in short grasses that can't keep them covered. So along those lines, keeping it very sunny and reducing shade, reducing anything that is going to attract things like mice and deer to your yard. And then you can even, if you back up to the woods or something like that, you can put kind of a barrier of mulch or gravel, and that makes it difficult for ticks on the other side of that mulch or gravel to get over into your yard.
Really good information. Rachel Burkholder, thank you for your time this morning. We appreciate it. And just making people aware, these things are all over the place.
Yes.
Yeah, we appreciate it. Thank you.
No problem.
Yeah, you got it. You know, I have a propensity when I'm on the golf course.
Okay.
I call it a power fade.
Okay.
Is what I call it. And for right-handed golfers, that means a fade, the ball bends a little bit to the right. So it's got a nice little arc. And if you're watching Tiger Woods or Rory McIlroy, they do it really nicely.
Mm-hmm.
Mine is a little more drastic. It sometimes will take a hard, maybe 70-degree turn.
More than a fade.
I call it a power fade. That's what I call it.
Okay.
Some people call it a severe slice. Whatever you want to, however you want to describe it.
Uh-huh.
But I oftentimes will end up in the woods.
Okay.
And I'm like, I ain't going in there.
Because you don't want to.
It ain't worth it.
Yeah.
Believe me, that extra stroke that I have to give up is not making or breaking my round. I'm not going in. I'm not going into the woods and trying to find a ball when I got ticks everywhere. That's a no-go for me.
No. And, you know, when I hear tick bite, and, you know, the first thing comes to my mind is Lyme disease. And so, because I have some friends who have Lyme disease, and I know it came from ticks.
Oh, yeah. Really?
Oh, yeah.
What do they deal with?
Oh, like pain, almost like arthritic pain, like, you know, and they'll have like, they have good days and bad days.
Sure.
But yeah, but they deal with that a lot, though, like pain, like their muscles kind of pulling up.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, it's scary. So it's the bug sprays are very important.
You got to watch your pets, too. I mean, because, you know, the dogs can bring ticks into the house. You got to make sure that they're covered as well.
Absolutely.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah, it's scary stuff. Coming up on the other side, gas prices have fallen pretty significantly. It's welcomed relief for a lot of drivers in Metro Detroit. Can we expect it to stay this low? I mean, I paid, what, $4.20 yesterday or a couple days ago?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it is coming down pretty significantly. It's welcomed. But how long will this last? Could we see another spike? Or are they down here to stay? We'll talk about it with Patrick DeHaan next on WJR. So the average cost for a gallon of gas here in Michigan, according to AAA, today is $4.22. The national average is $4.16. So we're hovering right around the national average.
Yeah,
pretty
absolutely.
Good. Mm-hmm. But gasoline prices are falling, even as crude prices are rising. Why is that happening? Patrick DeHaan, the head of petroleum analysis at GasBuddy.com, joins us. Patrick, good to have you back. Why are they falling as crude's rising?
Well, they actually just went up. across Michigan, we saw prices going up to $4.39 yesterday afternoon. So a lot of the time that AAA data is a day behind, but that's what happened late yesterday afternoon. So we finally saw a little bit of a jump across Metro Detroit. Prices, average prices are only up about a penny as those numbers are updating in real time. But most stations across Metro Detroit now back at $4.39. So we enjoyed a little bit of a lull there. Prices had come down for 3 weeks on the hope that there'd be a deal between the U.S. and Iran. But prices can only fall so far while oil prices remain, you know, still quite a bit above where they were a few months ago, $90 a barrel this morning. Thankfully, it's still lower than $115 a barrel like it was a month and a half ago. Mm-hmm. But some of the refining issues that also pushed prices up considerably in late April and early May, those refining issues have been sorted out as well. So gasoline, even though it's up today to $4.39, that's still quite a bit lower than $4.99 like it was in late April. And diesel prices have come down by over 50 cents a gallon as well since basically late April. So refining issues improved. Oil prices remain relatively low, but a little bit of a jump at the pump after several weeks of declining prices.
Patrick, we continue to see significant price differences across the state. You know, why are drivers in places like, you know, Ann Arbor and here in Metro Detroit paying considerably more than those in Flint or Lansing?
Well, as I mentioned, most states did make that jump up yesterday, but when prices go down so significantly, stations can lower prices either faster or slower, just depending on if they want to be real aggressive. And with prices have been, above normal prices in the last 3 months because of the whole situation, some stations may not be in a hurry to lower prices and fear that prices could go right back up. So whenever you see such a huge decline in the price of oil, it really all comes down to competition, how quickly competitors will start undercutting each other. And that's why when prices do go down, you shouldn't rest on your laurels. That's actually when you have a potentially more likelihood of overpaying uh-huh. by not shopping around for those sub $4 prices that did pop up.
How does OPEC factor into all of this? Are we seeing the ramifications of the UAE leaving OPEC? Does that play a role for us here in the United States?
It probably won't play much of a role until the straits reopen or until that's sorted out. But, I mean, that is a pretty big deal that's been masked by what's happened. Now talking about OPEC, the interesting thing here that while the situation, the U.S.-Iran situation, has been ongoing 3 months now, the Saudis have been moving record amounts of oil through their east-west pipeline. That's a pipeline that basically has just been sitting mostly idle for years as a backup plan. And that's part of the reason why oil prices likely haven't been impacted to a more significant degree is the Saudis are spending about 7 million barrels a day of oil. They're redirecting it away from the Persian Gulf over to the Red Sea. And that is part of why oil prices haven't gone up more. In addition, China has really reduced imports, not necessarily reduced consumption, but they've cut back on imports. And that's another reason why prices today aren't probably higher than they would have been otherwise.
Summer travel season is underway, Patrick. And if these current conditions hold, where do you see gas prices here in Michigan heading, let's say, by the 4th of July?
Well, it's very troublesome to try and predict this. You probably heard a lot of oil executives. Chevron CEO had said, we could see $150 oil. And they're not necessarily wrong. It's just very difficult to know how all of the events are going to unfold here in the weeks ahead. I still worry that as we are releasing oil from our strategic reserves at record rate, that eventually there will come a time when oil prices slingshot. But I just don't know if that slingshot is going to be, July or if it's going to take until August. But in the backdrop of all of this, the U.S. Strategic Reserve, as we're talking this morning, the data is going to take another few days to show this. But my bet is at some point here in the last 24 hours up to this morning that the Strategic Reserve is now at its lowest level since it was filled up back in 1983. And that in and of itself isn't cause for panic, but it's highlighting the uncertainty over, well, when the releases are over, there's not going to be as much oil on the global market. So it's very difficult to predict where we'll be for July 4. I tend to believe that somewhere between $3.99 to $4.99 is where we'll be. Hopefully not above that, but there still is that possibility.
Interesting. Breaking a couple of minutes ago, according to the New York Times, U.S. exports and services rose 2.6% in April. as exports of oil and petroleum products have kicked up too. So how does that play into what we're seeing?
Well, the U.S. is selling more of its oil overseas, and that's putting upward pressure, or generally will put upward pressure, on what you and I are paying. Oil companies can sell to the highest bidder, just like when your house is on the market. The goal of selling your house is to whoever is willing to pay the highest offer. And so other countries are trying to buy more U.S. oil to feed their refineries. They're also buying U.S. gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. You know, I'm sure most folks have heard about the jet fuel issues that have been brewing in Europe. Now, most of those have been mitigated by airlines that are trying to increase efficiency. But yeah, the more of our products flow overseas, the more pressure there is on what you and I are paying, simply because it's diverting the product that would be sitting in our supplies, and it's sending them abroad. So there's a double-edged sword here. When the president says, you know, come buy our oil, that does put upward pressure on what we're all paying.
Interesting stuff as always, Patrick DeHaan. We appreciate you. We'll talk again soon.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you got it.
Always good to have the gas prices going down.
No doubt about it. Meanwhile, Apple rolling out a major overhaul of their Siri iOS 27. They unveiled this at their Worldwide Developers Conference. It's one of the biggest upgrades to their voice assistant in years. And this is part of Apple's effort to push into the AI space.
Okay.
Much more AI-driven features. They say Siri is going to be much more useful. It's going to be conversational and integrated into your system.
Okay.
But they expect Siri to better understand context and handle more complex requests.
Oh, you can just have a conversation with your friend Siri.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
I was reading a piece in Axios, and they said, hey, this is great. Apple's rolling out the new Siri AI-driven update to their software. Unfortunately, they're 2 years too late. Anthropic and ChatGPT and all, you know, everybody has already done this.
Jumped on it, yeah, right.
And Apple a little late to the party.
Oh,
all right, that's going to do it for us. Have yourself a wonderful Tuesday. We'll see you tomorrow, same time, same place. Kevin Dietz and Alltalk coming your way next, right here on WJR.